to Resounds, arts and culture on the High Plains. I'm Corby Skinner.
And I'm Anna Page. And we're sharing stories of creative people who live and work in the Intermountain West.
Billings author Donnell Jones spent 7 years researching and writing about a Sierra Leone writer and barrister who is the subject of her latest book, An African in Imperial London, An Indomitable Life of ABC Merriam Labor.
During her research, Jones connected with Merriman Labor's great-nephew, Melbourne Garber. Both of them join us in the studio today. Welcome. So nice to have you.
Thank you.
Donnell, you were in the studio with your husband, 6 months ago, talking about your books. And your book has been nominated in nonfiction for a High Plains Book Award. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. I am so excited. It's really thrilling to be a nominee.
So I have to ask, I think this is interesting, because when I read the book, you had to do so much research and speculation. And I always wondered, should this be creative nonfiction rather than nonfiction? Or how did you make that decision?
I actually applied for both both categories because I do think of it as creative nonfiction, because I use the skills, the techniques of novelists to really bring this story to life. Now, that said, if you've had a look at the footnotes, you'll see that it's extremely well researched. And although I might have some speculation, that speculation is always grounded in historical fact. So I might have looked at another a similar person's experience. For example, there are places where I'll talk about the weather. That is not something I've made up. I looked up the weather every day that I talked about. If I said it was raining, that's because the historical records said it was raining.
And in your book, you certainly invite the reader to imagine what London was like, to imagine what Sierra Leone was like. But did you ever imagine that you would be meeting the grandnephew of your subject matter?
This is a really thrilling experience for me, because I spent 7 years getting to know a man who I would never meet in person. And I learned so much about his life, and I've read his writing very closely. And to me, to meet one of his relatives is an incredible gift. And poor Melbourne, I feel so close to him, because even though we've never met, I have spent so much time with this ancestor of his, that this is one of the best things that's happened with this book.
Now, Mel, we're so glad to have you in Billings. Traveled here from New York, and welcome.
Thank you.
What was it like to get contacted by Donnell and to find out that someone in Billings, Montana, was researching your great uncle?
Well, it was actually very intriguing. Donnell reached out to me, I think, through a mutual friend of ours, and said, "Yes, she's been writing this book, and the book was going to be coming out," and put me in touch with Donnell, and I spoke to Donnell about it, and she was really excited to actually speak with somebody who was a relative who also lives here, because she had also spoken to one or two other relations of Merriman Labor. But, I was really excited about this because I'm a bit of a history buff as well. About 3 years ago, I actually did a presentation in Sierra Leone where I was looking at different Creole people and their history. And one of the people I actually looked at was ABC Merriman Labor, and I did a little research about his life, and I presented it.
What's it like piecing together this puzzle? Donnell, you obviously spent years in this storyline. And to find someone with direct information must have been a real gold mine for you.
Yeah, it's thrilling. I mean, researching the life of a person who didn't leave a lot of records is difficult, but also exciting, because everything you find is new. And being able to just talk to family members and talk about information they have is helpful. But also, to me, to research somebody whose story I think is so important and has been overlooked for so long and find these treasures. My husband, Tim Lehman, is a historian, and he and I went to London 4 times, 5 times to deep into the archives to find important letters that were unknown before, business documents, all kinds of amazing things. And it really is, if you like mystery stories, that's what it is. I mean, I spent 7 years researching a mystery, and it's thrilling in that way.
Melbourne, I wonder, have you actually explored the DNA culture of your family?
I have seriously considered it. My older brother said, look, Mel, you need to do your DNA just so we know exactly who, where we're descended from. Because I'm one of the Creole people. The Creoles are the people who were really freed enslaved Africans who went back to Sierra Leone. So it started with the people they call the Black Poor, and then the Nova Scotian settlers, and then Maroons, and then liberated Africans. So there's a whole group of these blacks who ended up in Sierra Leone. And so we're not like an indigenous tribe of Sierra Leone. We come from different places. So it is going to be very interesting. And I intend to do my DNA to find out where I am from. But I know, for example, the Labours, they have a Maroon connection. The Maroons were slaves in Jamaica who ended up fighting the British and gaining their independence and living up in the hills in Jamaica. But some of them ended up in Sierra Leone, you know. And so we do know that we have some Maroon connection. And so it's going to be fascinating.
For people that haven't read Donnell's book, even though London is in the title, the beginning of the book takes place in Africa, and I was fascinated by the whole concept of the free town and the culture, the education that existed before the 1900s in Africa. Can you talk about that, Donnell, and tell us a little sort of prefix of the story?
Yeah, it's much as Mel has suggested here, that you have these diverse groups of formerly enslaved people going to Africa. These are people, some have been in London, some have been in Nova Scotia, some have been in Jamaica. They're returning to West Africa to start these new lives of freedom. And so you have, and then in the 19th century, the British abolished the slave trade. And when they did that, they put British, the Navy patrolled the west coast of Africa looking for slave ships from other countries. And they would capture those slave ships, release those slaves, those former slaves now, into Freetown. And so all of these people mixed together. And Freetown had this dynamic hybrid culture that was part British and part African. Because these people are embracing this kind of wonderful British education and ideals, but they also are bringing with them these rich traditions and rituals and knowledge of their lost homelands. So I think that when Creoles study their DNA, it will be of people from all over the African continent, because these are genes that have traveled from all over Africa to North America and then back to Africa. So it's this wonderful and exciting blending, melding of all different kinds of people. And the people who had been in in Nova Scotia were particularly interested in education, and they'd been Europeanized a great deal. So they brought all of that knowledge with them as well. And I think, you said the title of the book, and the title is The Indomitable Life of ABC Merriman Labor. But the Creole people were and are indomitable. That's one of the things I found so exciting.
I had almost forgot about Nova Scotia. I mean, we're covering a lot of countries and a fascinating history. Donnell, maybe you could read a little bit from the book that sort of sets up the story?
Well, I'm going to read you an excerpt that I think illustrates the kinds of things that the Nova Scotians, some of the first people that would go on to become Creoles, had to endure when they first went to Sierra Leone, to kind of really articulate that sort of indomitable spirit. And this is at the end of the 18th century in Africa, in Freetown. The Nova Scotians endured bitter challenges as they set to work building Freetown, their new settlement. The inhospitable climate of the tropics battered them with sweltering heat and torrential rain. The humidity rotted their cloth, rusted their metal tools, and covered leather with mold. Swarms of insects stung them and infested their stores of food. 18-foot-long snakes slithered into their tents and makeshift huts. Illness and death were constant shadows. Anna Maria Falconbridge, a wife of the colony's, and this is a British commercial agent, observed that, quote, "It is quite customary of a morning to ask how many died last night." The Nova Scotians would make tentative progress only to be beaten down by another catastrophe. During the British wars with France, for example, 7 enemy ships attacked the town. Crews ransacked homes and churches, ruthlessly destroying prayer books, smashing the printing press, shattering medicine vials, tearing apart furniture, crushing telescopes, and savagely slaughtering the settlers' animals, livestock, pigs, dogs, cats, until almost nothing was left. And yet, they rebuild from that and build this vibrant culture. When Merriman Labor was young in Freetown, there were 2 newspapers, there was a free library, there were literary clubs, there, he gave readings all the time. It was a really intellectually vibrant place that carried, and the bookstore carried, all the most recent titles from Britain.
Danelle, your language throughout the book is so captivating. It doesn't feel like we're reading a retelling of history that is traditionally a little dry. How did you capture that voice throughout, that feeling that your book conveys that is so much more than just a history story?
I think I wanted to tell a story about a real person in a way that would help people connect to his life and times. Because we may think that we know about London, but really all of us are strangers to London in 1904 or 1910. So I really worked hard to craft language that would be vivid, that would give people vivid pictures, not only of life in Sierra Leone, that is the very beginning of the book, but also this kind of vibrant place, London, Edwardian London, we call it, full of all kinds of wonderful things, you know, tons of traffic, motor cars eventually, people singing on the streets, pickpockets, all this wonderful, you know, vibrant life of London. So I really tried to evoke a place through images and language so people would see this is a story that needs to be heard.
And Mel, you, like your great uncle, you were born and raised in Freetown, Sierra Leone, and then you were educated in England. What was it like reading this book and putting yourself into Merriman Labor's shoes like that?
Well, just a point of correction. I actually was born in England and then went to Sierra Leone to live when
yes,
I was 6 months. No, you wouldn't have known that. But I basically grew up in Sierra Leone until I was 19. And then I went to England and I studied in England and then I worked in England. So I lived in England for about 14 years. And then when I heard about Danelle's book and I got the book before I actually even started reading the book, I actually got the book that ABC Merriman Labor wrote about Britain through Negro eyes. And it was actually very fascinating because a lot of what he said reflective till today in England. And Danelle's book just really, you know, for me it was I almost felt I was my great uncle, you know, going through what he had to go through, and then just realizing, you know, it might have been 80 or 90 years before I went, but a lot of the things there was still reflective of you know what I experienced in England. And so it really is, as you said, it's a very vibrant book. It's you know, you could immerse yourself and feel that you're this person walking through and experiencing some of what he experienced. One of the interesting things, Danelle mentioned something about the printing press. Well, the Labour family actually had a printing press called the Michael Morris Printing Press in Freetown, where Merriman Labor actually lived with his uncle for a long time. Myself, growing up as a child, my mother would take us to the same printing press.
Wow.
So I used to go there. We used to go. My siblings would go play there, and we had a one of our uncles who was now the custodian and managing it, and we would see all setting all the presses and stuff. And so when I was reading that, I'm thinking, wow, I know this place, you know. And so it really resounded.
You know, it's fascinating because as a reader, I don't think we know very much about history. We don't know very much about Black culture. And reading about Miriam Labor taking information back and forth from London back to Africa, it was just fascinating to think, here's this great intellectual mind, and we didn't know. I guess we just don't assume that was even around or available. So I found the book fascinating because of that. It really opened my eyes to what was happening at the turn of the century.
Yes, and I think that, in fact, quite a few colonial people in Africa and Jamaica and other colonies received British educations. I mean, Merriman Labor went to the most prestigious grammar school in Africa, and he studied Greek and Latin and math and science and, of course, British culture and British geography and British history. And he asked, why as an African am I only learning these topics? Why aren't I learning African languages, African history? But I think there was and is a vibrant intellectual tradition there. Merriman Labor's grandfather on the other side, well, actually, his family on both sides, both the Merrimans and the Labors, were very well educated. And his grandfather on the Merriman side was a well-known educator. And both his father and his uncle were journalists. I mean, they did other things as well. But his uncle, Joseph Sebastian Labor, started a newspaper, a well-known newspaper. And so he comes from this very literary, bookish family. So he was confident that he could go to London and he would be able to show them the skills that he had as a literary person.
He was confident, but he was also very dapper.
He was.
I found that so interesting. He loved sort of the fashion and the high society that London offered.
Yeah, you know what he loved? I mean, he considered himself a gentleman. So he wore the attire, you know, in England, in Britain at that time, what you wore indicated what status you were. Right. So if you were a gentleman, if you were educated and a gentleman, you would wear an appropriate top hat and suit. Right. That's what you wore. You weren't a laborer. And so that was part of his British identity, was absorbing those kind of, you know, class distinctions that were so clear in Sierra Leone. But he also loved all the educational opportunity in London. He went to museums. He loved going to, you know, listen to these kind of all these amazing public things that were available. Kew Gardens and all these just amazing opportunities that he found in London. And I think that's the reason he stayed there for 15 years, because he loved all the things he could do there.
I was just going to say as well, if you look at pictures of the Creole people around that time, they all were, especially the gentlemen, their pictures were all very dapper. They all had their bowler hats or top hats, you know, and nice suits. And the ladies were always in long flowing gowns. And again, that was just part of the culture that they had inculcated. And you know, and I still see some of these pictures of these from the late 1800s of all these gentlemen, you know, with the severe looking faces. They didn't smile at the pictures, but they all were dressed to the T's, you know, and that was just the part of the Creole culture, because they wanted to reflect that, you know, they were gentlemen and ladies.
Melbourne, tell us a little bit about what you're involved with now. I think it's interesting. You're a consultant, but really primarily involved with a lot of the arts and cultures. You're living in New York?
I live in New Jersey, but I work in New York. Mm-hmm. And yes, I have been involved. I'm a structural engineer by profession. And fortuitously, I have been involved in certain projects that are very dear to me and very culturally sensitive. I was just telling Danelle this morning, we were talking about Native Americans here in Montana. And I said, oh, I worked on a museum and research center for a Native American tribe in Connecticut. And they built a whole museum. They're called the Pequot Nation. And I learned a lot about that. I've also been very fortunate to work on some memorials in New York City. The first one I actually worked on was actually the Irish Hunger Memorial. And then that from there, I learned about the potato famine that actually brought a lot of the Irish to the Americas. And I was the engineer for that memorial in downtown Manhattan. I then also worked on the African Burial Ground Memorial, which for me was very personal to work on. It's a small memorial, but what had happened was they were building a federal building in New York downtown, and they had excavated for three or four levels of basement, and they found all these bones, and the contractor actually wanted to just try and get rid of it and so they could work, but there was a stop work order. They actually ended up exhuming all these remains, and they found the remains of probably about 300 Africans there. Mm. And so the land adjacent to the building was now put aside for a memorial, which I actually worked on in 2006, 2007. And it's called the African Burial Ground National Memorial Monument. And so it was very poignant to work on something like that. It wasn't a big job, but it was very, being who I was, it was very important. And then I've done a third one, which is at the United Nations building in the plaza, and that again is another memorial to the victims of the slave trade and the transatlantic slave trade.
Danelle, that sounds like another book.
I think so.
That is so fascinating. And it only goes to show that our histories and who we are still yet to be uncovered. There's so much information.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that if I dedicated the rest of my life to writing about just the other members of the labor family that I've met, I would have a very full career.
I'm so curious because you both are so history-minded. What is the attraction to the past, to document, to honor and preserve? What attracts you to that?
That's a good question. I think that every generation has to look at where we've come from, who we are. How do we know who we are unless we've looked at the past? We may reinvent ourselves all the time, but really we have to look at the past to know what kind of people we are. And so there are important stories from the past that have been forgotten, and they have things to tell us about who we are now. And that's what I think about Merriman Labor's story. People of African descent have been in Britain for a long time, and they've been contributing to British life for a long time. And I think it's important to remember that we have actually lived in a global world for centuries now. This isn't new. This isn't a 21st century thing. So living.
You mean we used to? I think there's some effort to minimize all of that, which is, I think your point is so well made, is we have to honor and explore our history if we're going to learn.
For me, the Creole people, we have a saying which I told Danelle, which basically translated means, if you don't know where you're going, know where you come from. And so that is part of this historical journey. For me, that's part of the historical journey. We have an organization called the Creole Descendants Union. And my mother is actually the president of the organization in Sierra Leone. And she used to come to the America in the 90s right through to late 2000s. And she would, there's quite a number of us here in the U.S. And she said, you guys need to come together because it's not just about learning the history. It's about being a voice and an advocate for the Creole people. There's issues in Sierra Leone I won't go into, but, you know, she is the one who actually got me interested into this history, as well as when I was doing this African burial ground, I started learning a lot more about the history. And so I've now become, you know, I had an anthropologist or historian who told me, you know, Mel is somebody you should talk to about the history of, you know, Sierra Leone people, the Creole people. And to me, it was for a historian to recognize that I knew a lot about the history was really a very great honor. And it's just one of the things I continue to pursue. I keep learning so much more all the time.
Now, Mel, you're a passionate advocate for the preservation of Sierra Leone's historical sites and artifacts, and you're currently involved in efforts to preserve the Bunce Island slave castle.
Yes.
I'm curious to know a little bit more about that.
So I'll be very brief with this. The slave castle, the Bunce Island slave castle, was the most important slave castle most important slave fort for the British, because it was their main trading post in West Africa, and from there they transported tens of thousands of enslaved Africans directly to the United States, especially to South Carolina, Georgia, and Florida, primarily because of the rice plantations. They also obviously transported them to the Caribbean and other places like Haiti and Grenada. But a lot of them, the bulk of them, actually came to the U.S. But what makes it important for me is that the slave fort was so important, it was destroyed and built six times. The very final time it was destroyed was in 1794, after the Nova Scotian settlers had settled in Sierra Leone and were starting their life. The French came, they destroyed Freetown, and then they destroyed the Bunce Island slave castle. But then it was rebuilt in 1796 because the slave trade was still going on. And it was rebuilt with the help of these Nova Scotian settlers, people who became the Creole people. So for me, Bunce Island is not just about preserving the history of the slave trade. It's a place that, you know, the history might not be glamorous, but it's part of the Creole history. It's something that we need to remember that our ancestors had to do this because there was nothing else to do at the time. And, you know.
So. That is fascinating. And I'm sorry, Danelle. I think that is another book. The connection between Nova Scotia, Sierra Leone, London is just wonderful. And it really points out, when we dig deep into history, we can find out marvelous stories that are still relevant today.
Absolutely. And I was just wondering if we could end with Mel saying that Creole saying in Creole.
If you don't know where you go, know where you come out. Which literally means, if you don't know where you're going, know where you come from. For me, that's it.
Mel Garber, thank you so much for joining us in the studio. Danelle Jones, always a pleasure to have you. Thank you both.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains, is produced by Corby Skinner, Anna Page, and Ken Siebert for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music by Alex Naumann. Additional funding provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. More information on Resounds is available at ypradio.org.